You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. Earlier this month, the world was saddened to hear of the death of Professor Stephen Hawking, arguably one of the most famous physicists of recent times. He died peacefully at the age of 76, having lived for more than 5 decades with the debilitating condition of motor neurone disease, which he was diagnosed with in his early 20s. Despite that, he contributed hugely to science and its popularisation. And to talk more about Stephen Hawking and his contributions, I'm joined by Professor Peter Coles, who's based jointly here at Cardiff University and also at the University of Maynooth. Welcome to the programme, Peter.
Hello, Chris.
Now, most of Stephen Hawking's scientific contributions are fairly specialist in narrow elements of cosmology and astrophysics. He's famous for things like Hawking radiation, this idea that black holes can radiate energy, as well as contributions to cosmology. Do you think you could describe some of the work Stephen Hawking's done over the years, but perhaps starting with Hawking radiation?
It seems a very paradoxical thing, if you just talk about it, because one thing we know or think we know about black holes is that by very definition of them, light can't escape from a black hole. They're surrounded by what's called a horizon, and if you try and shine a torch out of a black hole, the light gets curved round and it can't escape. So I think what's really important about this work on Hawking radiation was that work on black holes, the idea that we have about black holes, is basically totally classical concept. It's to do with classical general relativity. And what I mean by that is that there's no attempt in the normal description of a black hole to put any quantum theory in it, none of the quantum behavior of matter in it. We just think of space-time as a completely smooth thing and matter as being completely smooth, and all the theorems assume very simplified things about matter. So what was important about Hawking radiation was that Hawking, it was not just the thing itself, the phenomenon of Hawking radiation, but it's part of a process of trying to understand how you might put a very strong gravitational field, like around a black hole, together with a quantum theory of matter. Right. So an attempt not to do a quantum theory of gravity, which we still don't know how to do, but how to put some aspects of quantum behavior together with general relativity. Hawking was exercised by the problem of what happens if you look at a quantum behavior of matter around the edge of a black hole, around the horizon of a black hole. And the approach he used is often called a semi-classical approach, not full quantum gravity, but it's quantum field theory in a curved space-time. That's actually quite hard to do, but it's not a full quantum theory of gravity because it doesn't quantize gravity. The space-time is still classical, but you put a quantum field on top of it. And what he found was quite extraordinary, which is that actually the presence of the horizon means that actually there's some energy that's not accounted for. And after much to-ing and fro-ing and disputes and so on, it was generally established, and Hawking proved this formula, that actually what it means is that if you have matter, the region around a black hole is radiating. And that's because even empty space in quantum field theory has fluctuations in it, which you can think of as particles coming into existence and out of existence on a very short time, virtual particles. And these particles, if you like to put it this way, some of them fall into the black hole and other ones escape.
Yeah.
And it's the ones that escape that produce the Hawking radiation. Nobody's observed this, of course. It only actually is a significant thing for very, very tiny black holes. The Hawking radiation makes the horizon of a black hole sort of glow. It radiates with a certain temperature, like a star. But if you made a black hole of the same mass as the sun, the Hawking temperature of the horizon of that black hole would be 100 nanokelvin. The Hawking radiation is absolutely irrelevant to all the other stuff that would be going on. Stuff would be falling in, and you know, all kinds of other stuff would might be colliding, producing gravitational waves. You know, so it's really only for very small black holes that it makes any difference.
And by small black holes, we're talking subatomic mass,
microscopic black holes. So the upshot of all this is that black holes don't just fritter away; they actually evaporate completely and actually explode in the end. When the mass goes to zero, the temperature goes infinitely large. So the upshot of all this is that if it were possible to make tiny black holes, they actually live for a very short time and end up blowing up. I mean, people are scared of black holes because of science fiction movies and things. But a tiny black hole with just all it has is a tiny amount of mass, and it doesn't do anything else.
There were all these scare stories when the Large Hadron Collider turned on that it was going to create black holes, and a lot of the scientists involved, I understand, were going, so what?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, so what you, they might be creating black holes in the Large Hadron Collider. It's a possible phenomenon. There's no direct evidence that that actually happens. And in any case, there are collisions with cosmic rays in our atmosphere, which are far higher energies than the Large Hadron Collider can generate. And so these things would have been going through, if these particles could be created, they would have been created for the entire history of life on Earth and never harmed anyone in that period. So that was a load of nonsense, really, that story. But black holes, it's actually one of those, it's like a trigger phrase, isn't it? People are scared of black holes because they think, oh, it's dangerous. But actually, it's just a small one is not dangerous at all. But it is dangerous if it evaporates because it produces radiation, you know, and that is would be very energetic, gamma ray type radiation, which would
could be dangerous.
Could be dangerous. So there's a beautiful paper about this in Communications in Mathematical Physics. Very long and dense calculation, but very beautiful. But at the end of it, there comes a formula, a single formula. A wonderful formula because it includes, for the first time, really, the constants of nature, which are to do with quantum mechanics, Planck's constant, relativity, the speed of light, gravitation, gravitational constant, and Boltzmann's constant,
which is
the thermodynamics. And all, you know, pages and pages of very complicated differential geometry and field theory, and then there's a wonderful, very simple equation at the end that tells you what the temperature of a black hole is. And I think that's a classic. If they want to put anything on Hawking's tombstone, I think it should be that. If it all he'd done in his life was that work on Hawking evaporation, he'd still be a very famous scientist. But of course he did other things as well.
We'll come on to those other things later on. Now, Stephen Hawking is often assumed to be someone who has worked on his own, independently, with his own theories that he's thought up. But I wonder whether that's the case. One of my colleagues here in Cardiff, Professor Bernard Schütz, was a member of Stephen Hawking's group in Cambridge in the early 1970s. I spoke to Bernard and began by asking him what it was like in the group and how collaborative the environment was.
When I joined Stephen's group, I was there for a year on a fellowship from America. It was before he had done the Hawking radiation. And so it was very interesting. There was lots of things going on with Stephen and with people around him. It was an exciting time. I think it was collaborative, but it was already difficult for him to communicate rapidly. So he was at a stage where he could still drive a specially equipped electric car around Cambridge. And that was a very familiar scene on the Cambridge streets. He would turn up at the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics in Silver Street. He'd pull into the courtyard, and then he'd be helped into a motorized wheelchair. He'd go up a ramp into the building. He could still talk slowly, but you could make out his words. And one of the enduring memories I have of him is the sort of twinkle in his eye. He certainly, he didn't feel he had a chip on his shoulder or anything. He liked teasing people, and he liked joking. And so the atmosphere was quite pleasant. He had a cluster of people around him all the time. He had special graduate students who would help write things down, and he would dictate to them. But there were a lot of people working with him at the time, yeah. After being in Cambridge, I was a postdoc at Yale University. And in late 1973, this preprint arrived from Cambridge with Hawking's calculation of the Hawking radiation, saying that black holes really do emit thermal radiation. And we had a number of experts in quantum mechanics and in this whole area of trying to build a quantum theory. And the universal first reaction was, oh, this can't be right. There has to be something wrong with this. And that's, you know, that's not uncommon among physicists. You really want to take something apart. So people really tried to take it apart.
Which is the way science is meant to work, right?
That's how science is meant to work. That's right. That's not hostility. That's making sure that things are right. But the gut feeling was this can't be right. But after a couple of days of really studying the paper, people changed and they realized it was right, and that we have to revise our gut feeling about what is going on in nature and in quantum mechanics and in relativity, and that this is really a totally unexpected landmark result. And I think that's, to me, also the most important scientific contribution that Stephen made, which was to come into a field that he hadn't worked on before and totally turn it upside down, with a result that has endured ever since. That's just a mark of brilliance that very few people ever show.
Now, as famous as Stephen Hawking is for Hawking radiation, it was far from his only contribution to science. And in fact, his first big breakthrough was from his PhD thesis. Here's Peter Coles again.
I think it was a bit of an accident that it happened. In the early 60s, Roger Penrose, another brilliant mathematician and physicist, had been working on the collapse of black holes. He was trying to prove or disprove whether when at the end point of a star's life, when its ability to support itself by burning fuel is exhausted, whether it necessarily collapsed to a singularity, a point of essentially infinite density. Now, Penrose actually had a totally different way of doing general relativity calculations. He had a method that was very geometrical, less to do with manipulating algebraic symbols and complicated mathematics, and more to do with a very sort of, if you like, visual way of thinking about surfaces and bundles and things like that. Differential geometry is the field that he used. So Hawking found out about this, and he thought, well, actually, I really like this mathematical approach. It's beautiful. What if I try and apply this not to the collapse of a black hole, but to the expansion of the universe after the Big Bang?
To turn it around.
To make do it
come
backwards.
Out. Yeah.
Can we apply this technique? It sounds trivial, but it's not. There are a number of complications in doing that. But what he did, together with Penrose, because they worked collaboratively, got in touch and worked collaboratively on this, that actually the same thing is true of the Big Bang. So if you take if you run the clock backwards from our expanding universe and go back into the past, the early work on cosmology in the 1920s by Friedman and Lemaître and people like that suggested that there had to be a singularity, point of infinite density, at the beginning. But the Hawking-Penrose theorems showed that this actually was not exceptional. And in fact, it was an inevitable consequence that you have what's called a trapped surface, which essentially means that there's something where a horizon, it's like the formation of a black hole. And I think that was the last chapter of Hawking's PhD thesis. And I think that was what made him initially famous. And people realized that he really was an incredible talent. It makes it sound a lot easier when you say, oh, it was Penrose's stuff. And, you know, I took Penrose's idea and turned it around and just put a minus sign in somewhere. There's a lot more to it than that. But I think it took a lot of vision to realize that how to go about this problem.
One of the truly remarkable things about this early phase of Stephen Hawking's research career was that this all took place as he was coming to terms with his ALS, a form of motor neuron disease. This meant that his physical health was deteriorating, albeit not quite as quickly as the doctors initially expected. Theoretical physics isn't a vocation that requires physical activity per se, but wouldn't such a diagnosis make research almost impossible?
I think, in a way, despite the fact that he was stricken with this terrible disease, which basically confined him to a wheelchair for most of his life and paralysed him for much of the later part of his life, in a way, he was lucky. And what I mean by that is that he was able to do things, despite not being able to move his hands or write with a pen or anything like that, he could still make a powerful contribution. And a lot to do with that is Roger Penrose's way of doing general relativity, because it's very visual,
right,
very pictorial. You think of sheets and bombs. It's a very... I mean, actually, Penrose is an extremely talented artist as well. If you've seen him, does all his own drawings and things, and Penrose tiles and things like that. He's got a very geometrical imagination. Now, for a mundane person like me, when I do calculations, I can't do them without scribbling on a piece of paper and playing around with symbols and, you know, making lots of crossings out and starting again. That's the way I work. If you have an ability to visualize things and use symbols less, manipulation of symbols less, then you can do a lot without actually having to move your hands or without having to write anything down. You just think it through. And I think the fact that Hawking learnt about that kind of approach before he was really incapacitated with this illness meant that he could actually carry on doing that and make contributions now throughout his life. Now, he had people to help him write and so on. Later on, he had a machine to help him write. But I think the fact that he knew that he could still do something like that could well have been the thing that kept him going in the face of, you know, let's face it, a lot of us would have given up with that diagnosis when we're 20s. I mean, the prognosis for an athlete or someone like that who's got this disease is very poor because they just basically can't do what they've been doing anymore. Whereas Hawking, because he was a rather cerebral activity and also he had this geometric, this almost pictorial way of doing it, he could do it very well, despite not being able to move. And so I think, you know, you have to remember that he actually got the right approach in his mind to be able to deal with that as well as his illness.
The other thing Stephen Hawking is of course famous for is his work popularising science through books such as A Brief History of Time, published in the 1980s. Professor Mike Edmonds here in Cardiff has researched the history of astronomy, and I began by asking him whether such popular writings are a particularly recent development.
It's a tradition of people like James Jeans, Eddington, and so on in the earlier part of the last century. Fred Hoyle, towards the latter part of the last century in the UK. These were popular writers and had a big audience. In fact, there are examples in Edwardian and Victorian England too of that. And the idea of having a few figureheads, if you like, that write clearly, that are reasonably accessible, is, I think, very important. And it puts down as much a cultural marker as a scientific marker. It says, look, to other people who aren't scientists, you know, this is an interesting subject. This is a respectable subject. This is, you may not be able to follow every mathematical nicety, but you can get the general idea. And across culture, that's very important. Obviously, Hawking himself was inspirational for various reasons, not merely because he wrote reasonably well and you know, had that following, but also because of his particular physical handicap made people realise, well, here's somebody who's overcoming phenomenal odds in order to do something. Mm. And what's he doing? Well, it must be really important, or he must find it really important, if he's prepared to do that and overcome those odds and concentrate on that sort of thing. And it gives it a sort of, you know, a drive and I won't say a romance, but a sort of a feeling of validity that's rare, perhaps, but very important in popular literature.
It's very difficult to separate the work, the book, from Hawking, the phenomenon, in a sense. I remember quite a few years ago, 15 years ago, I was interviewed on the Today programme on BBC Radio 4 by John Humphreys, and suddenly sprang into my mind to compare A Brief History of Time with the Harry Potter books. And John Humphreys jumped to the conclusion that I was trying to argue that they were about the same amount of factual content or something like that. So it was a bad thing idea to have brought this up in the first place. But what I meant to say was that both of those phenomena, because they are publishing phenomena, were sort of off the scale in terms of the normal, you know, kind of what you'd expect from selling books. they're not just popular, but they were just amazingly popular all around the world. It's not so much the content of the book, it's people are buying into something which they want to belong to, in a sense. So the Harry Potter books, there's a whole franchise of costumes and films and all this kind of stuff. And I think if you judge J.K. Rowling's books purely as a bit of children's literature, you don't get the whole picture what's going on there. And I'm not being derogatory about Harry Potter books. They're great fun, and anything that gets kids reading is fantastic for me. Yeah. And I think there's a little bit of the similar thing with the Hawking book, because I would say, at the risk of appearing very critical, there are other books that explain much of what's in there rather better than he does. I think he's not very clear in some places, but I don't think that's the point about the book. The book is a sort of testament about the man and his achievements come from the person who's actually doing that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think people can forgive a little bit of lack of clarity or obscureness in the thing because it's actually authentic. I know lots of people who bought the book and never read it. But nevertheless, it really is an interesting phenomenon, that book. Now, when it comes to what did he do for science popularization, I think obviously it's great for physics to have somebody talking about physics all the time. You know, I think he became sort of synonymous with theoretical physics for many, many years. He was the person that you would go to. If you asked people in the street to name a physicist, they would name him Stephen Hawking.
Well, I've not got people on the street to hand, but what I do have is a bunch of physicists. I thought I'd go to the gravitational physics group here in Cardiff and find out what inspired them to do physics. First of all, here's research fellow Dr. Laura Nuttall.
I was always good at maths. I loved maths when I was in school, and it was just something that I just got. And I remember entering my GCSEs, and up to then, my final year at school, so year 11, I never had a physics teacher. And up until that point, I had been down to study languages at college. And I had this wonderful teacher from my GCSEs, Miss Back. And I don't know, there was just something that obviously she recognised in me. In addition to obviously being good at the math side of things, I really started to get into the physics side of things. Not long after I got to university, I think I realised I wanted to do a PhD. It was just trying to find something that I could really sink my teeth into. There was nothing that was really taking my interest until I remember, again, a very poignant moment in my life where a professor in my second year optics class happened to mention a weird contraption in Germany that was trying to measure the stretching and squeezing of space-time, and it would be a new form of doing astronomy. And I was like, that sounds delightfully bonkers. And it all spiraled from there.
Do you own a copy of Brief History of Time?
I'm afraid I don't. I've recently made a massive list of books that I think I should read that I haven't read, and it's a whole bunch of things, like, what's it called, A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, A Brief History of Time, and even the complete works of Jane Austen. So I'm slowly making my way through this list, but I haven't quite got to The Brief History of Time. Although I must admit, it seems weird that nobody's bought me this book yet for Christmas.
They probably think you've already got it.
They probably think I've already read it.
Let's hear from a few more members of the Gravitational Physics Group, starting off with Dr. Alex Van Ovenwalis.
I grew up in Spain, and being British, Stephen Hawking was maybe not as well known as in the UK, but still, as a scientist. Scientists would know about his work, and also the more general audience would have seen him on TV, his famous book, A Brief History of Time, had been translated to Spanish, I suppose, shortly after it was published. So he was well known, maybe not as much as in the UK. The way I decided to go into physics and afterwards gravitational physics was first, when I was at high school, it was hard for me to tell if I wanted to do something related to humanities or social sciences or science. And then at some point, when I was around maybe 15 years old, I decided I would probably choose science, probably physics, because I had been, astronomy, Einstein's theories, maybe not so much Stephen Hawking's at the time, but that got me quite interested, and I made the decision that I would probably study physics, and that's what actually happened in the end.
I came quite a roundabout way, so I read A Brief History of Time when I was 11, and enjoyed it and all that sort of stuff, and always enjoyed time in school. But then I got into economics, so the recession came and I thought, well, I'll go and be a banker. So I went to university, did maths and economics, and then sort of found it okay, was enjoying it. I think it was my third year when I was sort of deciding what to do next. I saw Interstellar, and then after watching that, I then went back and thought, oh, that was pretty cool. So I read Brief History of Time again, and also read The Science of Interstellar, the book by Kip Thorne, sort of explaining all the science behind the film. And then I thought, okay, this is something which seems interesting. So then I applied my master's here in Cardiff and have just carried on with it since then.
I think I've always been interested in getting into physics, but really it was throughout my kind of teenage years when you're watching TV and there's all these public outreach programs. The BBC in particular have done a great job on, you know, BBC 4. They do things with Helen Chersky, Jim Akalili, all these kind of names that are out there promoting all this exciting physics. I think that's really where my interest developed. I think it was really important that there were scientists doing the presenting. It lends a sense of credibility to what they're saying, especially with gravitational physics and these kind of high-end theoretical physics concepts. They can often seem quite outlandish, quite strange, really. So to have real researchers that are actually working in that field telling you about this is quite, I don't know, it gives it a bit more sense of reality to it, you know? I think what sent me towards gravitational physics in particular was the excitement in the concepts. So there's, of course, there's lots of exciting things throughout physics and engineering and everything, but for me it was, you know, when you first hear about black holes and all the excitement about that, you hear about when they say words like, oh, it's curving space-time, all that excitement, that never really leaves you, that thrill at thinking of it like that in those terms. So I think that's what led me to gravitational physics in particular.
I started out in engineering, aerospace engineering specifically, and I took a few classes, but I found that I was frustrated without the explanations behind what exactly we were doing. We would do these calculations from equations, but wouldn't know where they came from. So I was looking to get something more in-depth, study something that explained the ideas behind what we were doing. And I watched a video by Michio Kaku, which is now a bit embarrassing to say, but it is the ideas that he explained in the video were really interesting to me. It was really getting to down to like the basics of what physics is, and that intrigued me a lot. So I decided to pursue physics. I think the main important thing about these science outreach videos is that they spark an interest in the person who's listening to them. And whether that person is touched more by seeing an actual, like, PhD level professor, scientist, explaining what their research is, or whether that's more having the concepts explained by someone who just really enjoys science, is really, it's just up to the person. I say I watched a Michio Kaku video that first got me interested in physics, but honestly, I'd been watching a lot of videos like SciShow by Hank Green, who's not a scientist, but he does do a lot of science outreach and types of things. So I've watched a lot of that type of stuff, and that's what really got me interested. It didn't necessarily matter if the person was a professor or if just a science outreach. It's just the content that interested me.
That was Rhys Green, Dave Yields, and Samantha Usman there. Dr. Lionel London is a researcher here who worked on the theoretical predictions around black holes, not a million miles from what Stephen Hawking worked on. I asked Lionel how A Brief History of Time affected his career path.
I just might be one of these strange physicists who always wanted to be a physicist. Even before I knew what a physicist was, I was interested in religion, because I thought, you know, priests were the people who really understood the way the world works. Then it was architecture, then it was chemical engineering, then it was physics. But even having this very raw and latent interest in physics, there are a few things that really sort of helped hone the direction that I wanted to go in. I can remember one summer in particular when I was a kid, maybe 11 or 12. My mother would drive me around in the south in Georgia, and it would be these sweltering, hot, humid summers. We'd be going from house to house, and I'd sit in the back of the car with this book and go through it. And I remember no one else having any idea what I was doing. Every now and then someone would ask, you know, hey, Lana, what are you reading? And I'd say, oh, just some book, and they look at it, and they read Stephen Hawking's name and A Brief History of Time, and know it's physics, and you know they would, you know, sort of their expression would be of surprise and amazement. One of the things that I got out of A Brief History of Time, and that I think a lot of students of science in general really appreciated about Hawking's work, his books, his papers, is that science is both tangible. I mean, in every way. I mean, the universe is not something that's out there. It's something that's in front of us all the time. It's something that we're a part of. But it's also very transcendental. I think one of the lasting imprints that Hawking has made on my career is that he demonstrated that not only can, in being a scientist, you can overcome so many barriers in your own personal life, but that you can also transcend so many layers that society may put in front of people to understand ideas that are both devilishly simple and potentially profound.
It's clear that Stephen Hawking was a brilliant physicist. That almost goes without saying. But what about him as a person? His personal life is well documented in books and films. But what about the social side of his work? What was he like to work with? Here's Bernard Schutz again.
Well, Stephen was a very sociable person. He enjoyed people's company, so he would participate in any event that he could. He hadn't quite achieved the fame at that time. He was very famous within physics already, but not in the popular imagination. But there were lots of social events around Cambridge. He invited me to his house with Jane and kids a couple of times for dinner and so on. It was as normal as it could be, given the difficulties he had in interacting. But he tried to make it quite a welcoming experience for me. He also, because I was not attached to Cambridge University itself, because I had a visiting fellowship, he got me dining rights in his own college, in Caius College, which was splendid because they had very good kitchen, very good wine cellar. and he was very proud of that.
I had dinner at a conference, sitting opposite him at dinner. I was very honored to be asked to do that. And of course, that was a few years ago, and he needed help to eat. But the thing that I remember most about that is he clearly enjoyed people talking around him. He couldn't really participate. But he had very, very expressive eyes.
Mm.
And you could, if he thought something was funny, you could definitely see that he was amused. And likewise, if he was bored, he definitely looked very, very bored. So I think he must have been immensely frustrating for him, but I think he sort of enjoyed having people around who were, you know, sort of vaguely entertaining and not being boring. And I think he kind of switched off very easily when people were boring, but kind of liked to participate.
Well, some years later, 1999, when I was one of the directors of the Albert Einstein Institute in Germany, my fellow director, Hermann Nicolai, organized the annual meeting of the string theory community, and Stephen wanted to come to that. By that time, he was very famous, and there was lots of publicity. And we hired a marketing team to help us deal with the press and all that. I knew he was staying into the weekend. I knew he wasn't leaving on the Friday with most other people. And I said, what would you like to do on Friday or maybe on Saturday? And he grinned. By this time, he had to speak through the computer. He grinned and he said, I'd like to go dancing. And so I looked at the people who were taking care of him. I said, is he serious? So, you know, is this okay? And they said, yes, he loves dancing. We had to hunt down a disco in Berlin that was wheelchair accessible, which is surprisingly not very common. And we finally found the Hilton Hotel. And so that's where we took him on Friday. And he was out there on the dance floor, rocking back and forth. He had control over his motorized wheelchair. He could make it go side to side, you know, turning or back and forth with the music, and he was enjoying himself. He was having a ball.
So where does this put Stephen Hawking in the grand picture of physics? Is it really fair to say he's one of the greatest physicists of all time? Here's Peter Coles and Mike Edmonds again.
There are a great many brilliant physicists in the 20th century that most people have never heard of. And I think it's a shame that everything's kind of deflected on him. So, you know, if you're going to name your top 10 physicists of the 20th century, I would have had Feynman, Dirac, you know, Heisenberg, Schrodinger. Go back a century, you have Maxwell. You know, there's lots of people who have contributed a huge amount to science, and they're not well known. Hawking is well known. I don't begrudge that. But I think it's a shame that that people don't have a bigger picture of how physics is and how it's been done.
Yes, there are many physicists over the recent years who've won Nobel Prize. You find very few people, even among physicists sometimes, who could actually identify who they were.
The thing that makes me a little bit uncomfortable about all of that is there was a tendency to become a bit of a cult. I think there was a sort of... Hawking acquired a sort of mystical persona, partly because of the way it was hard to communicate with him, and he had this voice that came from somewhere else. Also, if you interacted with Hawking, it's one way. Basically, he speaks. You can't have a normal conversation with him. Mm. He has to do pre-prepared things with his voice when you talk to him. So the whole business of communication with him was very difficult, and I think that added to the sort of aura that he was a kind of otherworldly figure and somehow set apart. And it worries me a little bit that kind of people might have extrapolated to the idea that everyone who's a physicist is a bit like that, a bit otherworldly. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think physicists, he was a particularly brilliant physicist, but physicists are people, basically, and they all come in all different shapes and sizes and different personalities. And you don't have to be some kind of special status of person in order to be good at physics.
There's no denying that Hawking was a brilliant physicist, but how does Peter think he'll be remembered?
If all he'd done in his research career was the Hawking radiation paper, he'd still be regarded as a really important physicist and who did great work. And he did a lot more than that. Mm. So he is a really significant figure and a really brilliant physicist who we've very sadly lost. When I was at Queen Mary many years ago, he came to give a seminar in the relativity group, a technical seminar. Yeah. But it was after The Brief History of Time had come out, and we had to move it to a big lecture theatre because a huge crowd of people wanted to come. I mean, it was a full-on technical seminar about differential geometry and things like that, and it's quite clear most of the audience didn't understand anything he was talking about. And then when he got to the questions from the audience were all about, did he believe in God and with the life or not? And you could tell he was... He couldn't be bothered with that sort of thing. He'd come to do his work, and his work, I think, is what I think he'd like to be remembered for, and I think he will be. His classic things. And when the sort of cult aspects of it have gone away, people will still have the papers to look at, and they'll still say, this is really top-class stuff. He's really an outstanding physicist.
So there we have it. Stephen Hawking, a brilliant physicist with a twinkle in his eye at social occasions, a huge inspirational effect on younger generations. If you'd like to hear more about Stephen Hawking's theories, then there's an added bonus on the website with Peter Coles discussing Hawking radiation in more detail. That's at pythagastro.uk, where you can find this episode along with previous episodes in the podcast series. My thanks to Professors Peter Coles, Mike Edmonds and Bernard Schutz, and also to Laura, Alex, Lionel, Dave, Reese, and Samantha. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Reese Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.